to people all over the country who might want to bring charges. And even in this case, when E. Jean Carroll wins, if you can say that, let's not forget she was attacked decades ago. But even when she does, I mean, it's not only the mocking of Trump that Trump does at this town hall. What's more frightening is the cheers from the crowd in the audience. That's a lot to unpack.
Amy, it's horrifying. And what it says to me is, once again, we have to recognize the close connection between the health of women's rights and the health of our democracy. The two go hand in hand. When democracy is undermined, women's rights are undermined. Just listen to the way Donald Trump talks about his worldview of a world where if you're a powerful man, you can do what you want to women and you can get away with it. Remember the way he rubbed that in Robbie Kaplan's face during the deposition. It's been that way for a million years, he said. And then he paused and then he said, unfortunately, or fortunately, he wants a world where there's no democratic accountability, and specifically there's no legal accountability for men who perpetrate sexual assault. Amy, you're absolutely right that our civil justice system is out of reach for most survivors. I would love to see more of our wonderful law firms devoting pro bono resources to representing survivors. I personally have seen some law firms do that kind of work, and they've made life-changing differences for survivors. But there will never be enough pro bono representation to address all of the rape cases that exist. Moreover, there are defendants that are just not appropriate for civil relief. We need a functioning criminal justice system that is prioritizing rape cases over arresting nonviolent people for crimes of poverty and addiction. So we really need to redouble our efforts to make both civil and criminal justice systems more reflective of the true values of our community and the true priorities of women and all survivors in our community. I was chilled by what I heard in the CNN town hall last night. It was not a representative sample of the American public. It was a hand-picked audience of Republican Trump supporters. At the same time, I think it is essential that we realize that we have a long way to go before we have a legal system that truly reflects the values of Americans. Because I do believe that there is broad consensus among Americans that perpetrators of sexual assault should be held accountable, are not yet consistently being held accountable. And there's a lot we can do to change that.
And the anonymous jury, we just have 30 seconds.
The anonymous jury is not going to be a grounds for a successful appeal. There's no right that a defendant has to a non-anonymous jury. And the judge made a great record as to why Donald Trump's own history of attacking and endangering people with his inflammatory rhetoric was the reason why he chose to protect the jurors' identities in this case.
Jane Manning, we want to thank you for being with us, former sex crimes prosecutor, director of the Women's Equal Justice Project, which serves survivors of sexual assault. You can also go to democracynow.org to see our interview yesterday with Jessica Leeds, one of the two witnesses who testified on behalf of E. Jean Carroll, who describes being sexually assaulted by Donald Trump. Next up, we get an update on scandal-plagued Republican Congressmember George Santos, arrested Wednesday on 13 felony charges, still refusing to resign. Back in 30 seconds.
Looking back down the road from a little ways out, I never had a fear and I never had a doubt. If it had a lick of sense, I'd have figured that out pretty fast. But I wasn't any smarter than the average kid. Somebody might have noticed, but I never did. I never saw the future fading right into the past.
If It Don't Bleed by James McMurtry. The Texas musician has been performing an address at his Tennessee concerts in protest of the state's anti-drag law. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. The scandal-plagued New York Republican Congressmember George Santos pleaded not guilty to 13 federal charges at a courthouse in Long Island Wednesday. He faces 7 counts of wire fraud, 3 counts of money laundering, 2 counts of lying on federal disclosure forms, and 1 count of fraudulently collecting unemployment benefits. Santos spoke to reporters after he was released on a $500,000 bond just hours after turning himself in to the Central Islip Court.
I'm going to fight the witch hunt. I'm going to take care of clearing my name, and I look forward to doing that.
Why would you apply for unemployment benefits when you had a job making $120,000 a year?
Rachel, this is part of my defense. This is inaccurate information, and I will get to clear my name on this during the pandemic. It wasn't very clear. I don't understand where the government's getting their information, but I will present my facts.
So you were confused? The prosecutors say that you got over $20,000 in unemployment benefits, sir. How is that acceptable?
Ma'am, like I said, my employment was changed during the time. I don't understand where the government's coming from. I'll present my defense of that.
After a successful 2022 campaign for Congress, Santos, if that's his name, was exposed as a serial liar who fabricated his educational background, employment history, and religion. About a dozen House and Senate Republicans have called for Santos to resign, including a number of Republicans. But that doesn't include Republican House Speaker Kevin McCarthy, who said he'll wait to see if Santos is convicted. McCarthy spoke to CNN's Manu Raju Wednesday.
Santos said today he's running for re-election. Are you going to support him?
No, I'm not going to support Santos.
You're not?
Okay.
So you guys, will you work to try to defeat him in the primary?
Santos has a lot going on. But I think he has other things to focus on his life than running for
president. So you don't plan to support Santos for re-election?
That's what I said.
Republican leaders see Santos's vote as crucial in the House, where the party holds a slim 4-vote majority. If convicted, Santos could face up to 20 years in prison. Another criminal case is looming against Santos in Brazil, where he faces a hearing today on an allegation of check fraud. Meanwhile, in another case involving Santos, CREW, that's Citizens for Responsibility and Ethics in Washington, filed a complaint Wednesday with the Federal Election Commission that says Santos's currently listed campaign treasurer may not exist. CREW President Noah Bookbinder said, no one can seem to find Andrew Olson. If he doesn't exist, it would be an extreme abuse of our campaign finance system, one the FEC should not permit. For more on all this, we're joined by Mother Jones reporter Noah Lenard, who is in the courtroom in Central Islip as Santos pleaded not guilty. His latest piece is headlined, Santos Indictment Leaves Many Lies, Mysteries, and Scandals Unaddressed. Earlier this year, Noah and reporter David Korn did a story headlined, we tried to call the top donors to George Santos's 2020 campaign. Many don't seem to exist. Noah Lenard, welcome to Democracy Now! Just lay out both what happened in court yesterday. You were there on Long Island. And then what you have found in your investigations of this lying Long Island Congress member.
Yeah, thank you for having me on. So, yes, I was in the courtroom yesterday. Santos was arraigned. He had U.S. marshals behind him. He pleaded not guilty to all the counts with his lawyer, Joe Murray, there. And then there was $500,000 bond posted. And then they went to some other details. He surrendered his passports, for example. He's no longer allowed to travel outside of Long Island, New York, or D.C. Without the government's approval prior to. And then it was a very quick hearing. He left the courtroom, and there was just a huge media scrum. Dozens, scores of reporters swarming him, and then the clips that you played earlier in the show. But what we found earlier in the year was that, like so much of his story, so many of the things he's done are blatantly, not what normal candidates do. Many of his donors don't seem to exist. And what's amazing about this indictment is they've managed, the federal prosecutors have a very strong 13-count indictment, but it still doesn't even address many of the biggest mysteries about him. I spoke with Santos's lawyer, Joe Murray, after the hearing, and I asked him about the possibility of a follow-up indictment with additional charges, and he said that sometimes does happen. I wouldn't be surprised to see that here, because what you don't see in this indictment is a lot of the things related to his campaign finance practices. We still don't know where he got the more than $700,000 he loaned his campaign, where that money came from. Did he even loan that money to his campaign? So there are a lot of things we still don't know that we'll be finding out potentially in future indictments.
And Noah, what about the fact that this bond, $500,000, where did that come from?
So it's my understanding it's an unsecured bond. He also has 3 people, shorters, who are, endorsing it. So he's out now, but yes, he's basically very limited. He can only go between New York and D.C. He's voluntarily agreed to those conditions for now.
So I want to ask you about what he means in the House, that Kevin McCarthy still has his arms basically wrapped around him. He needs him. Yes, the Republicans have a 4-vote majority, but when it came down to the debt ceiling vote, he was the deciding vote, one vote. That was Representative George Santos or whoever he is. Can you talk about his significance in the House and what the House could do? I mean, the local conservative Republican Long Island Congress members, not to mention the majority of Republicans in his district, have called for him to resign.
Yeah, I think there's kind of a nice arrangement that's working out right now where, you know, basically you have particularly downstate New York City area and Long Island Republicans, you know, very strongly calling for him to resign. This is a huge embarrassment for them. They know they're running for re-election next year, and they do not want at all to be associated with George Santos. On the other side, higher up in leadership, McCarthy and other, you know, Republicans in House leadership know that they need his vote. They can't afford to not have it. So it seems like there's kind of an arrangement, formally or not, that's been worked out where the downstate Republicans get to say very mean things about Santos and say that he should step down, but at the same time knowing it's really not going to go anywhere, at least for now, at least until potentially a conviction or a plea deal in this case.
And Noel, could you talk about Nancy Marks, George Santos's campaign treasurer, and how she was complicit in what he's his various forms of criminal behavior?
Yes, I think there's a very important part of the story. She's not in the indictment, which is a pretty obvious thing that is missing, and obviously that's intentional. What's unclear is whether that's because she's talking to federal prosecutors right now or because she's not talking. It could be either. But the key part of it here is that she's the person, other than Santos, who almost certainly knows the most about what was going on with his campaign finance practices. For example, she's the one who signed off on a large series of $199.99 expenses, which is 1 cent below the federal threshold needed to keep receipts. So, you know, she's the person signing off on that. She also had her 19 and 22-year-old children give legal maximum donations of $5,800 to Santos. Many of her relatives did the same. There's no evidence they'd ever given political contributions before Santos's campaign. I spoke to at least one Santos relative who was reported as giving $5,800, and they said that they did not give that donation. So these are things that Marks would have been aware of, and Marks also would have been aware of, or should have been aware of, the fact that she was reporting maximum donations in the 2020 campaign from people who didn't, who almost certainly don't exist. I mean, for example, they were living at addresses in New York City that don't exist. They had names that nobody in the United States has that name. But in some cases, the name was very similar to some of Santos's relatives, with just one or two letters changed. So, you know, there's a ton of suspicious things that she is involved in, and it's possible that she's cooperating and is going to come to a plea deal and then give even, which will lead to even more indictments for Santos. Or if she doesn't, she may be facing an indictment of her own.
If you could very quickly, Noah, talk about what he's charged with, these cases, but then also, does his announcement that he's running for re-election is in some way means he can get more money for himself, since part of this is the fraud of raising money for his election, but then he uses it for himself?
Yeah, so on the first part, there are basically three parts of this indictment. The first is the most serious. It basically represents that Santos was telling people that he was a 501c4 nonprofit supporting his campaign. He was going to some of his biggest donors saying, hey, give money to this group. They did. It turned out it was actually a company that he controlled based out of Florida. And then he siphoned the money out of the company and bought luxury goods, paid off his car, et cetera. So that's a pretty simple one. The other is that he applied for unemployment insurance during the pandemic while he was working at what the SEC has called a Ponzi scheme. So he got about $25,000 of unemployment insurance. And then the third part is that he allegedly lied on two congressional disclosure forms, misstating his income and assets. So those, you know, those are the main things that are in the indictment there.
And crew, what they've brought forward yesterday about the non-existence of the of what his campaign treasurer?
Yeah, so he says, you know, Nancy Marks basically was removed herself or stepped down as treasurer, and now you have Andrew this person, Andrew Olson, is the treasurer. Separately from Cruen in the past, I've tried to find Andrew Olson. If Andrew Olson is listening, I would love to speak with him. I have not found any evidence of who this Andrew Olson might be or if it is a real person, and Crew has not as well. I mean, Andrew Olson is not a treasurer for any other Republican campaigns or committees or anything in politics. And he's listed at an address that is a Santos family address in the past. So there is, just like so many parts of the Santos story, many questions about who Andrew Olson is, if that is his real name.
We have 10 seconds. Which comes first, election day when he's running or a trial or a settlement?
I'd say trial or settlement, and I think George Santos is really hoping to retain the life rights so that he can sell this. He mentioned a book yesterday.
Noah Lenard, reporter at Mother Jones. We'll link to your pieces, including your latest Santos indictment leaves many lies, mysteries, and scandals unaddressed. Coming up, we remember the Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh, shot dead 1 year ago today by Israeli forces in the occupied West Bank. Stay with us. Eternity Looking for Us by Maya Hershey. This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Mimi Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh. It was 1 year ago today when an Israeli soldier fatally shot the Palestinian-American journalist Shireen Abu Akleh in the head as she was reporting on an Israeli military raid just outside the Jenin refugee camp in the occupied West Bank. She was shot while wearing a blue helmet and blue flak jacket, clearly emblazoned with the word press. Shireen Abu Akleh was one of the most prominent TV journalists in the Arab world. She'd worked for Al Jazeera for a quarter of a century. She was also a U.S. citizen. A year after her death, no one's been held accountable, despite detailed testimony from eyewitnesses to the shooting. This is an excerpt from the Al Jazeera documentary, The Killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, where a correspondent, Sharif Abdelkadous, spoke to journalists who were there at the time of her death. It begins with her producer, Ali Al-Samoudi, who was also shot.
When we made sure that there were no confrontations, we started walking slowly, with slow steps.
And about 25 seconds later, here they are walking with Shada and Mujahid up the street, all in their press jackets, just past the spot where Salim had a view of the military.
Suddenly, a round of bullets was fired. I shouted, "Shireen, they're shooting at us. We have to get out of here." Just as I was saying, "We have to get out of here," my shoulder exploded. I shouted, "Shireen, I was shot," or I said, "Shireen, they shot me."
After the first bullet, I was able to jump behind a short wall to take shelter. Shireen and Shata reached me to jump and get out of the place, but they couldn't.
He started firing at us. I immediately pressed record. I saw Ali was wounded. He walked away. Shireen was behind the tree. I could still see her hiding behind the tree.
The last words that Shireen said was, "Ali has been wounded. Ali has been wounded." I mean, these ears, every day, all the time, Shireen's voice is repeating in my ears.
I stepped forward again, and they started saying, "Shireen, Shireen," but they shot at us again.
I have a blank spot in my mind. I don't remember how I got behind the tree. I got behind a tree and turned around to see if Shireen could come to where I was. At that point, I saw Shireen falling to the ground. I didn't understand that she had been gravely wounded.
I stepped forward and saw Shireen on the ground. I'm holding the camera. I bend down. I want to walk toward Shireen.
The whole time I wanted to shake her, to touch her, to move her. But I was also filled with fear because the tree was what was protecting us. And if I moved her, maybe she would be wounded again. I remember when I saw the blood on the ground, when the blood started coming out, that's when I realized that she had taken a bullet to the head. And I started shouting, "It's her head, her head."
That was the Palestinian journalist Shatha Hanaysha in an excerpt from the documentary The Killing of Shireen Abu Akleh from Al Jazeera English's current affairs program Fault Lines. The documentary just won a George Polk Award for foreign television reporting. We're joined now by Sharif Abdelkaddous, the correspondent on the documentary. Sharif, congratulations on the George Polk Award, but it's hard to talk about congratulations today, this painful one-year anniversary of the death of Shireen Abu Akleh just outside the Jenin refugee camp. Can you talk about, at this point, one year later, what kind of investigation is being done? The U.S. government promised Tony Blinken, the Secretary of State, Shireen's family, this investigation would be done. Can you talk about what's happening now?
Well, I think the most important thing to understand is that one year later, after Shireen's killing, there's still no justice in her case, no accountability whatsoever, and very little pressure from, or perhaps zero pressure from the White House. Shireen was an American citizen, for accountability. So what's happening right now is that a few months ago, the FBI, independent of the White House, informed the Israeli government that they were opening a probe into Shireen's investigation. The Israeli government said openly that it would not cooperate with that investigation. There has been no public disclosure of where that investigation stands, so we'll have to see what comes out of that. There's also the U.S. security coordinator, which is the liaison on the ground in the occupied territories, said they were going to release, or Senator Chris Van Hollen announced that they're releasing a new report supposedly relatively soon. However, I don't think anyone is holding their breath about what the findings are in this report, because the State Department itself said just last week that there was no new findings or conclusions. And so if we look at their original report back in July, they said that Shireen was likely killed by an Israeli soldier, but that it wasn't intentional. They don't determine how they came to that conclusion. And that conclusion also contradicts all the video evidence and eyewitness testimony. And it's also confusing because apparently the security coordinator in this review met with Forensic Architecture and Al-Haq, two groups that together produced, I would say, the most comprehensive and detailed reconstruction of the killing. And in it, they show that Shireen and the group of journalists were repeatedly and deliberately targeted. They show a very high level of accuracy by the Israeli sniper. Despite that, the security coordinator is coming out with this report that very, very closely mirrors the Israeli government's narrative, which is that Shireen was caught in crossfire, although there's no evidence to substantiate that claim.
Sharif, you said, of course, that there's been little or likely no pressure from the White House on this investigation, the evidence of which was clear at the White House correspondents' dinner when Biden mentioned rightly mentioned two other American journalists, but did not mention Shireen at all.
That's right. President Biden met actually with the parents of Evan Gershkovich, the Wall Street Journal reporter who is unjustly being detained in Moscow on trumped-up charges. He He met with them before the White House Correspondents Association dinner. He paid tribute to them. President Biden declined to meet with Shireen's family, both when he visited the region last summer and when the family has come to Washington, D.C. Shireen was an American citizen, and her family deserves the same call for justice, the same push for accountability from the White House. And we also have to remember, you know, this is not, wholly, it's outrageous, but it's not surprising coming from the Biden administration, which, echoes decades of U.S. foreign policy, which is to back Israel and granted this impunity. And if we look at also the Committee to Protect Journalists just a couple of days ago put out a report looking back over two decades at the killings by the Israeli military of 20 different journalists. And they document very clearly a pattern of impunity and kind of very systemic similarities in Israel's response to each killing, including the most fundamental one, that no one is ever held accountable for them. But they include, like, this standard playbook, which is preemptive denials of responsibility, pushing false narratives, discounting evidence in the case, and internal investigations that lack any kind of transparency and never lead to charges. This is exactly what happened in Shireen's case, and it shows that this is a pattern of impunity. And again, look, this is one of the most prominent journalists of her generation, who was killed in broad daylight as she was wearing her press jacket and helmet with the words "press" clearly visible on them, with much of it caught on camera, with her colleagues there to witness it, with the citizenship of a country that's the main backer of the Israeli military. If we can't find justice for Shireen, what chance does anyone in Palestine have?
I want to go back to your documentary, The Killing of Shireen Abu Akleh. When you spoke to Senator Chris Van Hollen of Maryland.
This is an American citizen. We have a duty to pursue the facts wherever they lead, as Secretary Blinken himself said.
Senator Chris Van Hollen has led a group of his colleagues in pushing the Biden administration to investigate Shireen's killing.
Why do you think the State Department hasn't conducted an independent investigation yet?
Their new view, not the original words of the secretary, is that they will take these other investigations that have been completed. The problem, the challenge is they've reached very different conclusions. You have, first of all, the IDF report justifies the shooting and the shooting death based on claims that there was a crossfire. But you also have independent analyses that have been done that clearly dispute that claim. And the IDF has not put the facts on the table that show how it reached that conclusion. They've not made public their analysis.
This was a U.S. citizen. Do you believe the administration has upheld their duty?
I do not. I think we have a duty to do what the Secretary of State originally said. They appear to have backed off, but I believe, and many of my colleagues believe, that we've got to get to the bottom of this, and it cannot be swept under the rug.
So that's Maryland Senator Chris Van Hollen, who also questioned the nominee for U.S. Ambassador to Jordan a few days ago about Shireen's case. So when President Biden went to Israel and the West Bank, Tony Blinken and the U.S. government told the family, because he didn't meet with them, that this investigation would be going on. At this point, you saw on World Press Freedom Day just a few days ago, Medea Benjamin did a civil disobedience right at the feet of Tony Blinken, demanding to know more about what's happening with Shireen, with the investigation into Shireen's death. Your final comments, Sharif?
Well, I think we should go to the words of the family. They just released a statement, and part of it says, "Over the past year, our family has been forced to grieve while seeking justice and accountability for Israel's war crime. From the beginning, we've called on the U.S. government to act in the same way it would if any other American citizen was killed abroad." And they go on to say, "We miss Shireen every moment of every day. We wake up every morning hoping that we'll finally wake up from this nightmare. We love you, Shireen."
Sherif Abdelkaddous, we want to thank you so much for being with us. Correspondent on the new documentary, The Killing of Shireen Abu Akleh, produced by Al Jazeera's documentary program, Fault Lines. He just won a George Polk Award for foreign television reporting. Today is the first anniversary of the death of Shireen Abu Akleh in the occupied West Bank. That does it for our show, Democracy Now!, produced with Mike Burke, Renee Feldstein, Augusta Messiah, Rose Maria Tarasena, Tammy Warren, Trina Nadura, Sam Alcock, Tamari Astudio. I'm Amy Goodman with Nermeen Sheikh.
You're listening to CJSF 90.1 in Burnaby, British Columbia.